to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 25th of May 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it's the start of another week, and you know what that means? It means I must have my co-host Max Musson with me today from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today?
Hi, it's I'm really great actually. I'm feeling quite good about things. Staying active during the lockdown period as much as possible, keeping fit, that sort of thing, and enjoying the relatively good weather that we've been having. And I'm really looking forward to the government acknowledging that they got it wrong and them lifting the rest of lockdown. I think that would be a really good summer gift for everybody in the nation, and we could all get on with our lives and not be constrained in the way that we are.
Yeah, I definitely think we're going to see an accelerated lifting of what's been happening, and hopefully they'll allow people to have gatherings and get hotels and things open again soon. I'm not quite sure we'll see them accept that they got some of it wrong or apologise for it, but we can live in hope. But the main thing that seems to be going on at the moment, and this is fairly parochial, I guess it's not really international news, but there's a huge scandal going on at the moment around Dominic Cummings. And just to talk a little bit about Dominic Cummings at first, he's an advisor for the Conservative Party, particularly an advisor for Boris Johnson. He was a big Brexiteer. He's anti-political correctness, and the mainstream media really, really hate him. I mean, that was the first I heard of him, was just the vitriol and the hatred that The Guardian and The Mirror actually had for this man. And when you see him, he just seems like everybody else. He's not somebody that's trying to lord it over everyone. He really does seem like a genuine man of the people to me, even from his stance and the way that he carries himself. He wanted to take on somebody for the civil service about a month or so back, and the left-wing press exposed this person as being a race realist. And he was basically talking about the statistics that show that unemployment, crime, and also bringing up IQ and the IQ difference between the non-white races and white races, and saying, why are we bringing these people into our country? And Dominic Cummings wanted to employ him, and the press exposed this person's sensible views. Dominic Cummings refused to speak badly about the man. He refused to make a comment about it, although the man in question didn't get the job. And when you look on Dominic Cummings' blog, that was where they got all these comments from. So Dominic Cummings was obviously aware of what this man was saying. He's obviously aware of race realism. He definitely doesn't like the press and the way that they behave. And what's happened now, the press have discovered that when Dominic Cummings thought that he had the virus, in fact he did have the virus, his wife had the virus, he needed to go into quarantine, and the rules state that if you need to go into quarantine, you are to stay at home for a week or 2 weeks. And what Dominic Cummings did, he went to his family home, which is in Durham, to go into quarantine. He has some kind of an estate there, his parents have, and there was a separate house which he was able to stay in. He normally lives in London, and obviously that's for work. That's why he's in London. It's for work. And he had to go into quarantine. So he went to his home, his family home, to quarantine himself. Obviously because he's got a four-year-old child. And if him and his wife were taken into hospital, somebody would need to look after the child. It all seems very, very sensible to me. But according to the Mirror, he should be sacked for this. He should be resigning for this. And they're trying to draw parallels with the left-wing scientist who had to resign after getting caught going out for a bunk up with his missus when he was supposed to be at home, and the left-wing scientist in Scotland, the advisor to Nicola Sturgeon, who was caught going to her second home twice for a holiday. Dominic Cummings, I think, has been extremely sensible here, and the government have stood behind him, and they've highlighted the fact that he was putting his child, his child's health first and his child's safety first, because he thought, well, who's going to look after the child if we are both ill? But I think more than that, he's actually done exactly what he was supposed to do, which says that you're supposed to stay at home. And his family home is 250 miles away. He's only there in London because he's doing work for the government, and the government have said that that is essential work. So the left are attacking him for this, particularly Ian Blackford. Wee Willy Winky, I call him. He's this low testosterone, fat Scotsman who's a total Marxist, and he's been calling for Dominic Cummings to resign over this. And this is the same Ian Blackford that's been trying to get out of actually having to come to London to go to Westminster. He wants to just stay at home all the time. And yet Dominic Cummings, rather than being at his home in Durham, he's been in Westminster doing all the government work for the last 2 months, rather than saying, well, I want to be furloughed and I just want to stay at home. So, you know, total hypocrisy there from Ian Blackford saying that this is wrong. And I really, really hope that he doesn't have to step down over this. I hope that the government do stand by him, because I think he's just done the sensible thing. They're saying, oh, this means that all these rules can be broken now, everybody can just break the law, and he hasn't. And I'm amazed that he hasn't actually brought it up, the fact that all he did was stay at his family home, and that the press, the people that have been saying this about him, there's been a pack of them, a mob of them, waiting outside his house, and there's footage of him coming out from his house, and then you've got like a rugby scrum of the press. They are literally cheek to cheek shouting at him, thrusting their microphones in his faces. That only one of them had a mask on, and they're shouting at him, how dare you disobey the rules? And he's saying, 2 meters apart you're supposed to be. You know, every one of the press was breaking the rules themselves, while trying to make out that Dominic Cummings was breaking the rules, and saying that this is an absolute scandal. And personally, I think the general public are probably right behind Dominic Cummings and furious at the press for breaking the rules like this. I think it's absolutely disgusting the way that they're treating him. It's totally political. It's all just because they're left wing and they can't stand Dominic Cummings, who is just a centrist, basically. He's just sensible. He comes across as a nice guy, basically. What are your views on this, Max? It's really been winding me up all over the weekend. I really wanted to say something about it.
Well, I noticed the story on various news websites. I went to the Express website there, where they had an article where they were saying that the majority of the British public, according to a YouGov survey, want Dominic Cummings to be sacked. But then the Express did their own survey, and their survey came out the complete opposite of the YouGov survey, saying that 2/3 of the Express readers wanted Dominic Cummings to stay in his job. I think ever since Boris Johnson was elected, Dominic Cummings was identified as being somebody who was probably a little bit more radical right than the average Conservative of today. And as a result of that, he, in my view, has been a marked man. And at every step and turn along the way, the media tried to latch on to various things. I can't remember the actual instances where this has happened in the past, but it's happened fairly sort of regularly since Boris Johnson was elected. But at each one of these stages where there has been some possible pretext that could be used to call for Dominic Cummings' resignation, well, you know, all these sort of politically correct lefties have all been there calling for him to resign or to be sacked, and so far he's survived. And yeah, like you, I hope that he does survive, because one of the things that life has taught me is that if the media hate somebody, as a general rule, without knowing anything else about them, you can generally draw from that person is on the side of the good. Anybody that the media drools over and loves is going to be on the side of the bad. And so the more the media attack him, the more I feel inclined. I don't know him. I don't sort of haven't read anything that he's written or anything. But the more they attack him, the more I feel inclined to support him, actually. And I hope that the rest of the British public that have, if they've got any sense, learned to loathe the mass media, I hope they have a similar attitude. And as you say, I hope he survives and lives on.
Yeah, the media, I mean, it's really been highlighted how dishonest they are as well, because they've been saying that the police spoke to Dominic Cummings about this, and the government have said Dominic Cummings hasn't had anything to do with the police when he's at his family home. And it actually turns out that when he was at the family home, his father contacted the police about a security thing, and of course they had to notify the police that he was there. That the police weren't speaking to Dominic Cummings about him breaking the rules, and the press have been saying, when did the government hear about this, that Dominic Cummings drove 200 miles to his family home? And you think, well, obviously they knew about it. This must have been okayed with them, because he was going to need 2 weeks off work, because MI5 would need to know exactly where he is. His security would need to know exactly where he is. Everybody in the government must have known that he was there. And it wasn't that the police were giving him a dressing down. The police weren't throwing the rule book at him or anything like that. It was them contacting the police about a security issue. It's so dishonest of them. The same thing I've noticed this week, I mean, this is really in America, but with Donald Trump talking about hydroquinoline, if that's the correct term for it, the anti-malarial drug, and Donald Trump is taking that as a prophylactic against coronavirus. He doesn't have coronavirus. The whole point of that medicine is that people take it so they don't catch malaria, and people are taking it so they don't catch coronavirus. So the BBC are continually going on about how if somebody has coronavirus, they shouldn't be taking this drug. And they've been showing you these reports. They've just done a study in Italy or whatever, and they're saying, two-thirds of the people that took this drug when they were in intensive care died. You're going to die if you take this drug. And that's not what Donald Trump has been saying. That's not what the people with hydroquinoline have been saying, that promoting it have been saying. They've been saying, take this and your chances of catching the virus are so much lower. And they're just so dishonest. It infuriates me that they put across this message that is a total lie. It's totally not what is going on at all. And I think more and more people must be seeing through this. And Dominic Cummings is obviously furious at them. I mean, he sort of waves his notebook around as if he's trying to swat a fly to get them to move out of the way when he's coming out of his house. And he also said to them, they said, how do you think this looks? And he's like, well, doesn't matter how it looks. It's whether I've done the right thing or not. And I'm certainly not going to do anything to please you lot. And he's great the way he treats them. And yeah, holding his absolutely. Head high as he walks out. I just hope he doesn't resign. I really do hope he doesn't resign. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Max.
No, I think we've said all that needs to be said there. You know, the points that you've made, I think, are all valid points. And I mean, one thing that hasn't been sort of mentioned is that there's been a lot of people in the media saying how it's okay for people who are wealthy enough to have a house with a garden, because during lockdown they can at least exercise outside in the sunshine in their garden, which is perfectly true. And they've been doing this in order to whip up sympathy for people who live in overcrowded conditions in the centre of London or in parts of London, which primarily are then going to be people from immigrant communities. Nobody's stopped to think, well, does the house that Dominic Cummings live in London, does that have a garden? And if you were a family man and you were going to have to stay indoors and be quarantined for a 2 week period, and you've got a young child, then you'd probably want to quarantine that child in a house that's got a garden, wouldn't you? And so again, that makes it all the more reasonable that he may have decided to go to his family home in Durham rather than be quarantined in the centre of London in what might not be a particularly large accommodation.
Well, I think the home he has in London will be his work home anyway. I mean, obviously his parents obviously live on an estate because they've got a spare house in it, which Dominic Cummings and his wife could stay in. And also it was his sisters that were bringing him food. So that's his home. His family home is in Durham. I mean, he's in London because he has to be in London for work. And the guidelines are you must stay at home. So all he's done is actually travel to his home. They're forgetting that he's actually been at work all this time. That's the bit that really gets me. I mean, everybody else has been at home, that's been furloughed, and he's been working because it's seen as essential work. But when he has to be quarantined, why would he want to be staying there, in the workplace in London? As you say, Max, you'd want somewhere with a garden and with your family around you so that they can bring you food. And in cases, in case they get ill and his son needed to be looked after. And there are far more important things than that that are going on that are being covered up by this. I mean, just one other thing I'll just say before I get into that. I mean, they're also saying he's been seen 30 miles from the actual home. Well, you're allowed to go somewhere to exercise, and he was seen out going for a walk. So they're making a big thing about that as well. But what they're really doing is covering up more important stories. Nigel Farage did a wonderful bit of investigative journalism last week. He went out on one of the fishing boats out into the channel to observe what was going on with these fake refugees that are invading the country. And the footage that he got was actually of the French Navy escorting these rubber dinghies into British waters and then liaising with the UK Border Force so that the UK Border Force could then effectively pick these people up and shepherd them in to Britain. And when they saw that Nigel Farage was on board and he was trying to film this, they started making threats. They said they were going to impound the boat. Breitbart have actually looked at the satellite recordings that we've actually got of this French naval vessel, and it's come almost all the way up to the beach, basically. I mean, maybe it's a slight exaggeration, but way into British waters, so that they can effectively just hand these fake refugees over to the UK Border Force, who are then just shepherding them in. And hundreds of them have been taken advantage of the fact that everybody in Britain is under house arrest at the moment. In order to do this, they're bringing over people with coronavirus from the camps. Priti Patel has been told about this. She's made an excuse. She said, well, it's under international law, and the French Navy, they have to rescue people if they're in distress. And these fake refugees, they say, we don't need rescuing. And then when they get to the British waters, they say, oh, help, help, we do need rescuing. And then by that time, because they've gone over that measure point in the channel, the UK Border Force pick them up and bring them in. She's saying that it's a problem with international law, but they are fake refugees. They should be looked at as invaders. That's the way they should look at this. The real thing that they should be doing, they should just be sinking those boats. If you were to just sink one or two of those boats, say, look, you're trying to break into the country, it's the same as if somebody's trying to break into somebody's house, and we're going to shoot the boats, that would be it. No more boats would come. And you would have lost a couple of people or whoever was on that vessel. But how many other people have they lost at sea, which is their excuse for doing it? These boats will come. They will have an accident. Hundreds of lives have been lost at sea. And if they were just to treat them as enemy invaders who've already broken the law by trying to break into the country and just saying, look, we need to defend the country, and then it just wouldn't happen anymore. And you would save hundreds of lives at sea. But of course, they won't do that because they will get all emotional over it. But that's all they need to do is change the definition. Or that's one way of doing it. I guess there are others. There's the Australian way. What did you think of this, Max?
Yeah, I think it's disgusting. I think really what's happening now is we're seeing the same sort of thing happening in the channel that's been going on in the Mediterranean for several years, where what you've had is arrangements whereby either French or Italian naval ships are escorting boatloads of migrants into ports on the southern shores of Europe, having where those migrants in their small boats have been shepherded out across the Mediterranean by the non-governmental organisations that work to promote immigration into Europe. And so, again, people say, oh, these poor immigrants, they've braved all these seas and risked their lives. And yet there have been one or two boats that have gone out in a more irregular fashion and have come a cropper as a result of it. But the vast majority of these boats get escorted out of the territorial waters of Libya and places of that sort. They get halfway across the Mediterranean or just into Italian territorial waters, and then the Italian Navy has to come past and pick them up and take them into an Italian harbour. And so effectively, these people are being given a free ferry service across the Mediterranean. And exactly the same thing is happening now across the Channel, where they're getting a free ferry service courtesy of the British taxpayer as far as the border force is concerned. But in reality, all the border force needs to do is to have a I'm sure there are some cruise ships that are going really cheaply at the moment because of lockdown and the fact that the tourist industry is pretty much on its knees. And so it'd be very easy for the government here to buy a small cruise liner, park it in the middle of the English Channel, and have all of these people on these boats moved onto this cruise liner, and then have it chug round into the Mediterranean and drop them all off on the north coast of Africa where they came from originally. That would be the sort of thing that any British government worth its salt would be doing.
That's a fantastic idea, Max. That really is a fantastic idea. I was just thinking then you were going to say we can just have this big cruiser and we'll just moor it there in the Channel and they can stay on there until they decide they want to go home. But yeah, why not just steam round to the Mediterranean and drop them off? And the Australian way of dealing with this is they've got camps for them, not actually on Australian soil, but somewhere else in New Guinea, I think it is. They've got asylum centres in New Guinea. And if these people try to invade Australia, they just get taken to New Guinea, or they get taken back to where they've come from. It's their choice. And they've managed to get the illegal invasion of Australia down to, I think, about zero. Because these people aren't fleeing from war. They're not trying to get somewhere safe, and Australia happens to be the first safe place they can get to. They've particularly chosen to go to Australia, the same as they have particularly chosen to come to England. There's no war that's going on in France. They're not fleeing from oppression in France. It's a total lie what they're saying. And yet only 15% of them are actually sent back. 85% of these fake refugees whose first act on British soil is to break the law are allowed to stay in the country. They have everything provided for them. Apparently, there's been 1,085 of them that have turned up since we've been under house arrest. And this is increasing weekly, and it's not getting into the news. It's only Nigel Farage that is highlighting this. Breitbart are funding him to highlight this. And this is the sort of thing that the British public would be furious to hear about. And it's being covered up. And instead, we're hearing about Dominic Cummings and how terrible it is that he drove to his parents' home or his family home just to go through quarantine. I think part of that is also the fact that he obviously could do that. He could go to another house. He could get out of London. And I think there's a certain amount of class envy that they're trying to instill in the people. The newspapers that are doing that are the Mirror, the Guardian, and the Observer. And they've got some of the SNP and the Labour politicians that are joining in with it. And it's just covering up news stories like this. And there's another news story as well. This young girl called Ellie who has shown pictures of her being bruised and battered, and her fingers are all cut, and she's been saying that there's a grooming gang that's operating in Barrow. They did this to her because she was unable to go and see them under the coronavirus lockdown. So there are lots of people that are corroborating her story. I forget whether it's six girls have made this complaint or nine girls have made this complaint, and the police have come out with a response, and they've arrested Ellie. They've arrested the girl that made the allegations. They've said there's no proof of a grooming gang, and yet none of the police have been around to Ellie's friends to actually check on what she said was true. The Maggie Oliver, I think her name is, the actual police lady who resigned from the police but who was responsible for getting the original investigation into Rotherham off the ground, she is supporting this girl, Ellie. And about 100 cars were out over the weekend protesting at this. And it's all over Facebook. There's a hashtag, Justice for Ellie. This has been happening in Barrow. Once again, the whistleblower, the victim, has been arrested rather than the people that the allegations have been made about. And it's very hard to work out exactly what's going on, because you would think, well, surely the police know by now that they've got to do something about this. And if you've got this ex-policewoman that was responsible for the investigation into Rotherham supporting this Ellie girl, and there are lots of other people that are corroborating her story, then you think, well, you know, this girl's got to be telling the truth. And again, the British public would really want to know about that, but they're not being told about it. There was a story in the Daily Mail about it, and that was about it. And it took a lot of pressure with this happening on Facebook before the Daily Mail would actually say anything about it. These issues are far more important. Are young girls being trafficked and raped and attacked by the newcomers? The newcomers lying and pretending to be fake refugees and invading the country while we're all locked in our houses. All of that is far more important than Dominic Cummings going into quarantine and deciding he would be better off doing that at his family home rather than in his work home in London. I just hope, you know, people realise it.
Yeah, and I think what's happening here is that going back to the immigration story, there have been various agreements between the European Union and African countries. I think there's an emergent African Union, which is going to be the kind of African equivalent of the European Union, where they've come to an agreement. And I think it was in Marrakesh or somewhere like that a few years back. They came to an agreement whereby there would be assisted immigration from Africa into Europe, and that they would work towards regularizing immigration rather than allowing it to continue to be illegal. You know, when there were when the public of Europe and the public of Britain are concerned about immigration, full stop, irrespective of whether it's legal or illegal, what the authorities do is they take up a position where they are only concerned about illegal immigration. And the way in which they eliminate or attempt to eliminate illegal immigration is by making all immigration legal. That's their answer to it. And so what we can see from this is that the governments of Europe have been complicit in the migration of people from North Africa into Europe. It's not something that's been happening outside of their control. They're complicit in it. They're actually enabling it to happen. And what we can see now with the migrants coming across the channel is that, again, the governments of Europe are complicit in this happening. As far as the French are concerned, the French are supposed to be in lockdown, aren't they? The same as we are. And aren't the French supposed to have a more severe lockdown than we've got here in the UK? But somehow, apparently, all these migrants can travel from the southern coast of France all the way across to the northern coast of France without anybody asking them why they're travelling unnecessarily. And then, as we've already discussed, they get escorted out of French territorial waters by the French Navy, and then they're escorted from the margin of British territorial waters into British ports by the border force. And the fact that the border force have been doing this when the governments, successive governments, have known that the British people don't want immigration from the third world, shows that the British government, successive British governments, have been disingenuous in their assertions that they're going to combat immigration, and they're going to reduce the numbers, or they're going to combat illegal immigration. They're just completely disingenuous in this because they're all complicit in it. And the issue over this young girl Ellie and the bruising, etc. Well, the police apparently are supposed to have been investigating the issue for a year, and now they're saying that they've found no proof. Well, is it that they've got no proof, or is it that they have found no evidence? And there's a difference between failing to obtain proof and finding no evidence, which would tend to suggest that if they found no evidence of any wrongdoing against this girl, then I would find that very, very strange in view of the fact that her body, from the photographs that she published, her body is just covered in bruises and cuts and injuries that she's sustained somehow. Now, either she has got an incredibly high pain threshold and she's been self-harming herself and unable to self-harm herself on parts of her body that you can't normally reach, Or if somebody's been attacking her, and if somebody's been attacking her, then the police have had a year to find the person. And I would suggest that it's far more likely that somebody has been attacking her than that she's some sort of contortionist that's able to inflict self-harm upon herself in the most remote parts of her body. And if she had made her allegation about what's going on in Barrow, in the absence of there ever being anything like this ever anywhere else in the country, then we might accept that the police are a little bit dubious, might be a little bit dubious about what's going on. But when this kind of thing that has been going on in virtually every large town and city throughout the entire country, and this has been happening for virtually two decades now, it beggars belief that the police don't believe her story. I think that what this tends to indicate, again, is that the authorities in this country regard these kind of issues as political issues. They don't want these issues to be aired. They don't want people to discuss them. They don't want the public generally to become aware that these things are happening. The issues are being swept under the carpet, and it's been happening so consistently this way, as I say, over two decades, that you have to eventually reach the conclusion that the authorities in this country are complicit in these attacks on these girls. They know it's happening, and they're quite prepared to let it continue happening, because anybody who was a senior police officer in this country and who had any real intention of stamping this out would have stamped it out long ago. It wouldn't take two decades, and then it's still going on. It's happened, you know, as far as this girl Ellie is concerned, she alleges that she was assaulted again only sort of two or three days ago. You know, it's well overdue that the police in this country should have stamped out this sort of thing. And had it been the other way around, had it been white pimps that were pimping out immigrant girls, this would have been stamped out, and that the full force of the law would have been thrown behind the investigations, and the people that were found guilty would have been dealt with very, very severely.
It looks like there's collusion in both cases, isn't there? Collusion to cover up the grooming gangs, collusion to bring the fake refugees into the country. And time again, it's been the victim that has actually gone to the police and said, this is what's going on. It's been them that have been arrested. The Twitter feed, as I say, by this ex-police officer that's highlighting it, it's just full of girls saying, yes, the same happened to me. I was arrested and charged with perverting the course of justice when I went to the police about the grooming gangs. So we'll just have to keep following that. I suspect that's going to be a major story over the next week. But should we get into the second part of our presentation on Sir Ranulph Fiennes now, Matt?
Yes.
Yeah, well, let's start with a bit of a recap with what we went into last week. I thought there were a couple of things that we could have gone into a little bit more. He went to Eton College, which we didn't really talk about very much. And that's really the poshest college in Britain, isn't it? Am I right in thinking that? Or is that Eton School? That's the one that the
it's the poshest public school in Britain, yes.
Yeah,
public school. For any American listeners, a public school isn't a school for the public. A public school in Britain, it means it's a private school where only the children of the wealthiest attend.
So he really didn't need to have gone into the army and done all the things that he did. He could really have just been part of the aristocracy and used the connections that he made at Eton College. And also the fact that he didn't actually get any A-levels, and yet he still went to this college. I guess his family must have thought, well, even though you're not really that academic, we want you to go to this college anyway because we would like you to make those connections. But he still went out and joined the army and joined the SAS. And as we heard last week, they got this greasy pig and they threw that into the bowl. And just I was just thinking about that. And last week we said, well, that would have made all their suit and tie and ballroom dresses, it would have made them all very dirty. It also would have been very, very hard to catch this piglet that was covered in grease that was flying around the hall. And yeah, and we also heard about him blowing up a concrete dam that had been built by Hollywood that was a hideous carbuncle on the most picturesque village in England. And then he fought the communists for Sultan of Oman. And then he went back there and discovered the Atlantis of the Sands in 1992, the lost city of Ubar. And I had a look into that, and some people have questioned whether that actually was the lost city that he found, but he definitely did find something there, ruins that have been lost for centuries. And then we talked about some of his expeditions, and we asked whether his expedition used sleds that were dragged along by dogs. And in 1993, he actually became the first person to cross the Antarctic continent on foot, dragging a 450-pound sledge. So he was dragging this sledge himself. And I think that's a quarter of a ton, isn't it? I think a ton is 1,000 kilos, and that's 2,200 pounds. So 450-pound sledge, that's a quarter of a ton that he was dragging across the Antarctic on foot. We talked about how he got frostbite and he cut his own fingertips off. And I just wanted to make a point about that. I've had to do blood tests at home before, and you get like a little plastic device with a lance inside it, a needle inside it. And you can't actually see the needle, but you just have to push this little bit of plastic against your finger to make a little pinprick so that you can then squeeze the blood out into a little test tube. And the difficulty you have with doing that, the difficulty there is with actually injuring yourself in some way, to think that he cut his fingertips off with a buzz saw, it's just incredible.
An electric fret saw.
Electric fret saw. I mean, just, you know, incredible. I mean, the difficulty I have just putting this pin into my finger, and to think that he was able to just put his hands through a fret saw is just incredible. And then we talked about the marathons that he had run in the Arctic and in the tropics, how he'd almost climbed Everest but stopped because he was having heart problems, and then he tried to climb it again and he almost got to the top, and then there was bad weather, and then finally he became the oldest person to climb Everest. And he had lots of other Antarctic expeditions and marathons that he ran, and we covered most of his expeditions. And then I think we got up to the bit where we were going to start talking about some of the books that he'd written and some of the talks that he'd given. Was there anything else that you wanted to revisit there, Max, that we talked about last week?
Not only just that, one thing that's just occurred to me is that you've mentioned the lost city of Ubar. I described it last week as being the lost city of Iram. And apparently there is some dispute as to what the actual name of this place is. But Iram and Ubar are in fact the same place, just in case anybody else is looking these things up separately as a result of the discussion that we're having. So they are the same place. There's a little bit more that I'll say about that later on, but we'll save that for the time being. But as far as Randall Fiennes is concerned, he, despite having been a professional soldier, in addition to having been an expedition leader, he's also become an author, because obviously you can't do these kind of expeditions without having a log, and once you've got a log, it's the logical thing for you to do, to actually turn the log into a book and write about it that way. But Randall Fiennes has also written a number of fiction books. So he's written 24 fiction and non-fiction books in total. And in 2003, he published a biography of Captain Robert Falcon Scott, which attempted to provide a robust defence of Scott's achievements and reputation, which had been strongly questioned by biographers such as Roland Huntford. Although others have made comparisons between Fiennes and Scott, Fiennes says he identifies more with Lawrence Oates, another member of Scott's doomed Antarctic team, than he does actually with Scott. Although I think that's perhaps just a bit of modesty on Randall Fiennes' part there.
I would say that for somebody to criticise him, I mean, unless they've actually been to the Antarctic and actually done the same things as Captain Scott actually did, then they haven't got a leg to stand on to be criticizing him. I mean, this is the reason why he wrote the book, isn't it? Because he'd actually gone through exactly the same trials and tribulations that Scott had. So he's eminently qualified to write this book. And you've just got this biographer that's criticizing him?
Well, I think what you have in the world of academia nowadays is a number of people who write biographies that are revisionist biographies of people who are the finest Britons, for example. They specifically seek out people who have been models for other people to follow and who are inspirational, and they then they write a biography of the person where they then pick them to pieces based upon modern day standards and modern day conventions, rather than viewing the person in the round and viewing them living at a time in the kind of environment they would have been living in at the time of their life. And I think that there is, sadly, and I think we've kind of touched on this in the past, there is an industry that sets out to besmirch the reputations of anybody who is somebody who's inspirational and admirable from our past, in order that we will have a diminished sense of identity and a diminished sense of national pride. And I think that it's excellent that Ranulf Fiennes has come to the rescue of Captain Scott and defended him in the way that he has.
Also, the fact that he's managed to write 24 books after not actually getting any A-levels. I mean, that's quite an achievement. 24 fiction and non-fiction books for somebody that's not academically minded. And they're well-received books. It's not like he's a bad writer. So that's another credit to him that I wanted to mention. Sorry to interrupt you there, Max.
No, I think it's quite a common thing, actually, that you get people who fail to... I think how the teachers describe it as a child failing to live up to its potential when they're at school sometimes. And very often it's not a matter that it's more a matter that the child is bored at school or feels depressed and constrained by all of the petty school rules that inhibits their learning, rather than that they're not intelligent enough to learn things. And I think that anybody who can plan and carry out an expedition in the way that Ranulf Fiennes has done on several occasions, would have to be somebody of exceptional ability just by definition. And so what you say is obviously true. But we're moving on now to just look briefly at his political views. And one of the things that I worried about, and that I've said to you a little bit earlier on, is that I think we should make it quite clear to anybody who's listening that there is absolutely no connection between Ranulf Fiennes and Real Britannia or the Radio Albion. We are not promoting him because we believe he's one of us or anything of that sort. He's not a member of any organization that we're a member of or anything like that. He is just an all-round good guy who we've identified as being a shining example to other people in the country, and somebody who should be emulated. But as far as his political views are concerned, it's known that he stood for the Countryside Party, and I have to confess my ignorance here. I'm not really quite sure what the Countryside Party stood for, though it sounds as if it's going to be a traditionalist kind of party, which is what one would expect of somebody with Ranulf Fiennes' background.
I think it was. I think it was to do with stop the banning of fox hunting law. Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think they had a huge march, and they did have lots of support. So he was probably supporting that traditionalism. As we saw earlier last week, we talked about how he must be a traditionalist because he didn't like this dam, this concrete dam, and took steps to get rid of it. So that sort of shows that he's got traditionalist leanings anyway. And also he when he was fighting against the communists, that shows that he's got patriotic leanings or right-leaning rather than left-leaning political views, I would suggest.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It's also been reported on a number of occasions, or alleged on a number of occasions, that he was a patron of the of UKIP. He's denied that, and I don't think there is actually any real evidence to suggest that he was. So, you know, that's perhaps just a misleading footnote in the accounts of him that are online. But he is, by all accounts, a member of the libertarian pressure group, the Freedom Association. Not that I'm very familiar with what the Freedom Association are trying to promote, but one of the things that Ranulph Fiennes did in 2014 was that he was one of 200 public figures who were signatories to a letter to The Guardian opposing Scottish independence in the run-up to that September's referendum on that issue. So, again, that kind of all fits in with somebody who is conservative with a small c, somebody who's a traditionalist, which, as we say, generally tends to fit with other aspects of Ranulph Fiennes' character.
He's probably an unofficial patron. Maybe he had donated to UKIP. And the Libertarian Pressure Group, the Freedom Party, I mean, libertarians support freedom of speech, don't they? So I suspect he's a supporter of freedom of speech, and that's great to hear that he supports libertarianism. Again, that's you know, it's very close to nationalism. I'd say the guy's probably definitely a patriot, although we can't say for certain.
Yes, I think that would be fairly clear to say. In terms of media appearances, he's made several TV appearances as a guest on the TV program Top Gear. He was a star in a star in a reasonably priced car. So he did went around the test track in the Suzuki Liana that they provided for celebrities to do this in, and apparently lapped the in 1:51, which put him 26 out of the 65 celebrities that had taken part. So not a dazzlingly fast driver, but not too bad nonetheless, sort of pretty much middle of the pack, I suppose that puts him there. And he also appeared in a Polar special episode of Top Gear, where because of the overly jocular and not, you know, unserious way in which the Top Gear crew were conducting themselves, because they thought this whole thing was, you know, a bit of a laugh and a bit of a joke, apparently Ranulph Fiennes ended up berating them for their flippant attitude towards the dangers of the Arctic. And I imagine that he probably could foresee other people watching a flippant program about the Arctic, then thinking that it would be quite easy to try to emulate his exploits, and then getting themselves into trouble because they had underestimated the difficulties and the dangers involved. And so you can understand why he would have taken up that sort of a position.
There are places in Britain that have Arctic conditions, you know, the Cairngorms up in Scotland. There are places like that, and you could imagine that there would be idiots that would just go up there and not take the proper protective gear, go up there thinking, oh, it's a nice sunny day, not realise that, you know, you've got ice cold conditions there. The top of Scotland is actually part of the Arctic Circle, isn't it? It's quite unique, really, when you think of Britain, the long size of it. I think it's, 700 miles up to Scotland, and it's right sort of north and south. Mm. So you get quite a difference in temperature just travelling up and down the country, like a marked difference in temperature, and also in light, especially on Midsummer's Day. You know, it's light almost right the way through up in Scotland. And I guess maybe they even see the Northern Lights at times.
I don't know whether Scotland extends actually into the Arctic Circle, but it's not going to be a long way off. I've certainly flown to Scotland on a number of occasions and taken off in southern England in sort of reasonably bright and sunny conditions, and then got off the plane in Scotland with it being, dusk has already fallen upon Scotland. And so you can see that there is a marked difference there, and a marked difference in temperature as well, in the way that you've indicated, you know, it being like a couple of degrees colder by the time you get to Scotland. And also, interestingly, Ranulph Fiennes is alleged to have been considered for the role of James Bond, which I thought was quite amusing. And I think that Ranulph Fiennes found it quite amusing as well, because he mentioned that he was rejected by Cubby Broccoli for having hands that were too big and a face like a farmer. And apparently the role was then given to Roger Moore, who's evidently regarded as much prettier.
Has he got any acting credentials then? Has he tried acting at all? Or was this just, you know, well, maybe we could try Ranulph Fiennes just because he was a famous adventurer?
Yeah, I think it's because he's a famous adventurer. I've only ever met Ranulph Fiennes once, because I didn't really get to speak to him personally, apart from sort of cheering from the crowd. But he was, you know, I went to hear him speak, and he didn't strike me as the sort of person who would make a natural actor. And I can see that the humour in him being described in the way he was by Cubby Broccoli, if indeed that's what Cubby Broccoli actually said. But there we are. And he's featured in the game show Countdown on a number of occasions. And he's been an expert guest commentator on some documentaries. There was one documentary entitled Chasing Shackleton, which aired in January 2014, and he does make corporate and after dinner speeches, and I can tell you that his corporate and after dinner speeches would be pretty good and well worth going to listen to if you get the opportunity. And so, you know, as we mentioned last week, he has got a number of speaking engagements for the latter part of this year and the early part of next year, so they would be well worth attending from that point of view.
I'd like to see that documentary. I'll look that one out.
Documentary on Shackleton. 2009, he appeared in a three-part National Geographic documentary, Egypt with the World's Greatest Explorer. And it was also titled Fiennes Return to Egypt. And he appeared in this with his cousin, who's the actor Joseph Fiennes. And they retraced the expedition that he'd conducted in Egypt back in the 1960s.
So he has a brother that's an actor. So he does have acting connections there.
He has acting connections, yes. It may just be the impression I had of him that he wasn't somebody who looked like the sort of person who would make an actor. Although I may be wrong on that, and perhaps we'll see him in some kind of starring role in the fullness of time, but.
He's an all-round good guy, isn't he? He's just sort of good at everything that he picks up, really, isn't he?
Yeah, I would think he's the sort of person that probably would try his hand at something like that. Now, one of the aspects of the expeditions, etc., because some people might be sort of listening to what we've been saying these last couple of weeks and think to themselves, yeah, but why would anybody put themselves through those kind of physical strains and stresses and mental strains and stresses, you know, in order to do these things, to be the first man, the first person to circumnavigate the Earth, crossing both poles, etc. Why strive to be the oldest man to have climbed the Eiger, or the north face of the Eiger, and the oldest man to have climbed Mount Everest, etc. A great part of the expeditions that Ranulph Fiennes has taken part in has been fundraising for charitable purposes. And just sort of moving on to his personal life, it then becomes sort of obvious, why he has been so sort of energetic in fundraising. What it says, picked out of Wikipedia here, is that Fiennes married his childhood sweetheart, Virginia, otherwise known as Ginny Pepper, on the 9th of September 1970, and they ran a country farm in Exmoor, Somerset, where they raised cattle and sheep. Ginny built a herd of Aberdeen Angus cattle while Fiennes was away on his expeditions. The extent of her support for him was so great that she became the first woman to receive the Polar Medal. The two remained married until her death from stomach cancer in February 2004. Fiennes embarked on a lecture tour where in Cheshire he met Louise Millington, who he married at St. Boniface Church, Banbury, 1 year and 3 weeks after Ginny's death. A daughter, Elizabeth, was born in April 2006, and he also has a stepson named Alexander.
So you think he was doing these expeditions because of going through his wife dying of stomach cancer? Because I noticed that a lot of these were for Marie Curie, for the cancer charity.
That's absolutely correct, yes. So I think that his wife dying in the way that she did spurred him on then to use the expeditions for primarily fundraising purposes. And that's why I think we went through the amount of fundraising that he's done. I think he's raised something like £14 million and was awarded as one of the greatest celebrity fundraisers in this country, and I think that's down to the fact that he lost his wife to cancer.
Yeah, that would make sense, wouldn't it?
So in 2003, while attempting to scale Mount Everest, Fine suffered a heart attack and later underwent emergency bypass surgery. Then
how did they do that? How did they do that? I mean, what, on the mountain? They did the bypass surgery?
No. He had been taken back. But he suffered a heart attack and was rescued. But then I think, he then underwent the emergency bypass surgery. And so,
not many facilities in Nepal, are there? I mean, you're not going to expect very many, hospital facilities at the top of Everest and in Nepal and Kashmir. It's not going to be like European facilities.
No, well, I doubt that the bypass surgery was done there. It would have been transported back to civilization to have that done, I'm sure.
What a place to have a heart attack on the top of Mount Everest.
Not the sort of place you'd want to do that. But the point is that this is all part of his character. A lot of these expeditions have been done when he has been, what most people regard as middle-aged at least, or in some people they would have been looking forward to putting their feet up and enjoying their retirement. He's been in his 60s when he's accomplished many of these expeditions, and not only has he been in his 60s, but he's completed expeditions whilst he has subsequent to having suffered heart attacks and subsequent to having had emergency bypass surgery, etc. And one of the last expeditions that he went on, I think I mentioned last week, his GP would only allow him to take part in the expedition if he, as long as he made sure that his heart rate didn't go above 120 beats per minute. Ranald Fiennes forgot to take his heart rate monitor with him, so he completed the expedition not knowing what rate his heart was beating at all. And so this is an aspect of his personality where it's like sort of daring do, and let's just get on and do the job and not worry about all these like little technicalities kind of thing. And and so that's all part of the picture of the man, really.
Single-mindedness and always going to make his way through right till the end, finish the job regardless, no matter what, even if he has a heart attack or gets frostbite or anything else.
And then it mentions online the fact that in 2010 he was involved in a three-car collision in Stockport, which resulted in minor injuries to himself but serious injuries to the driver of one of the other cars. He'd been in Stockport to participate in the annual High Peak Marathon in Derbyshire as part of a veterans team known as Poles Apart, and despite the freezing conditions, managed to win the veterans trophy in just over 12 hours. So, again, he, as recently as 2010, he had been taking part. So he would have been 66, 67-ish years of age at that point there. And if we move on now to awards and recognition, there's like a whole list of things that he's been awarded as he's gone through his life, because you couldn't be as active as he's been, you couldn't take on and complete the challenges, etc., that he's taken on without people taking notice and without people wanting to give you awards for it. And so in 1968, while serving with the Omani Army, Ranald Fiennes received the Dhofar Campaign Medal. And in 1970, received the Sultan of Oman's Bravery Medal. He's also been awarded a number of honorary doctorates, the first in 1986 at Loughborough University, followed in 1995 by the University of Central England, in 2000, the University of Portsmouth, in 2006, Glasgow Caledonian University, in 2005, the University of Sheffield, 2007, the University of Abertay Dundee, September 2011, the University of Plymouth, and Fiennes later received the Royal Geographical Society's Founders Medal. So he's been recognised in by an enormous number of institutions there.
That's weird, isn't it? I would have you would think, well, somebody's a doctor, they get, if they've actually studied to become a doctor, they just do the studying the once and they become a doctor. I mean, how many times has he been given an honorary doctorship? I mean, what is he? Is it a doctor in various different disciplines that they give?
He doesn't have to study to be a doctor. When you're given an honorary doctor, it's just like being given a medal in honor of things that you've achieved in your own particular field. So these would have been doctorates that would have been awarded to him for his fundraising, I would imagine, and for his expeditionary exploits.
But he's already got one. If he's already got a doctorate, he's been made a doctor by the University of Plymouth, and then Glasgow says, well, we're going to make you into a doctor as well. And then, another part of the country.
Because it's these different institutions that want to honour him, you see. And so they all honour him by individually giving him honorary doctorates to their learning institution.
Now, I guess they can, they can say they've got a connection with him then as well. He can become like a patron.
And what will often then happen is that when they have prize, what do they call it, where they hand out the scrolls when all the students pass their degrees, very often they'll have a celebrity come and hand out the scrolls and also speak to the assembled students as well, and they want somebody that's going to be a celebrity and somebody that's going to be inspirational and somebody who can tell a good yarn, basically. And, I think that Ranulph Fiennes fits the bill as far as all those three things are concerned.
Yeah, it'd be great to be handed your award by him, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And in 1982, he was the subject of This Is Your Life with Eamon Andrews. Do you remember that TV program? You may be a bit young.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that.
You too, right? Mm-hmm. So he was caught by Eamon Andrews. And then he was awarded the Livingstone Gold Medal by the Royal Scottish Geographical Society. And so, again, this would have been another medal that he would have been given in honour of the life that he'd led and the expeditions that he'd successfully completed, etc. And again, in 1984, he was awarded the New York Explorers Club Gold Medal and was described in that year, as we've mentioned previously, by the Guinness Book of Records as the world's greatest living explorer. And the fact that he's been receiving these accolades internationally goes some way to substantiating what the Guinness Book of Records stated, that he is the world's greatest living explorer. Because if you were asked to name another explorer who's achieved more than Ranulph Fiennes has, you would have great difficulty coming up with a name, I think. In 1986, he was awarded the Polar Medal for outstanding service to British polar exploration and research. And so that was for reaching one of the poles. I'm not sure whether it was Antarctic or Antarctica that he reached first. But then he reached the other pole on foot, and so he's got the Polar Medal with, I think the term is dual clasps, which is like having a military medal and bar, so that he's got both those medals. And I think he is the only person to have a Polar Medal and with dual clasps. And so, again, that's another thing that is outstanding about him there. And then he was awarded an OBE in 1993 for human endeavour and for charitable services. And so the Queen and the government at the time recognised the outstanding contribution he'd made. And the figure I've got noted down here confirms the figure I mentioned earlier on, that he'd raised at that point £14 million for good causes. And along the way, if we just look at the causes that he'd raised the money for, in 1992, he raised $4.2 million for the Multiple Sclerosis Society. 1995, $1.6 million for Breakthrough to Breast Cancer. 2004-2005, he raised $2.3 million for the British Heart Foundation. 2007 to 2009, $6.5 million for Marie Curie. In 2013, $2 million for the charity Seeing is Believing. And then in 2015, there's an undisclosed amount that he's raised for Marie Curie. And in the year 2000, he was awarded the Explorers Club Millennium Award for Navigation. In May 2007, he received ITV's Greatest Britons Award for sport, beating fellow nominees Lewis Hamilton and Joe Calzaghe. So again, that's sort of an indication of in the great esteem that he's held in by the British public. In October 2007, Fiennes ranked 94th, tying with five other people in a list of the top 100 living geniuses published by the Daily Telegraph. So again, despite the fact that he failed his O-levels, he is one of the top 100 living geniuses.
Yeah, it's good to see that he's being mentioned in the same sort of sphere as scientists and astronauts and physicists and all that sort of thing for being such an amazing explorer. Yeah, it's not often you hear of explorers mentioned as being geniuses, is it? It's usually academics that are classed as that.
So in late 2008, early 2009, he took part in a new BBC programme called Top Dogs, Adventures in War, Sea and Ice, in which he teamed up with fellow Britain's John Simpson and BBC News of the World Affairs editor Sir Robin Knox-Johnson. I got that the wrong way around. So John Simpson is the BBC News World Affairs editor and Sir Robin Knox-Johnson, the round-the-world yachtsman. So they teamed up, and the team undertook three trips, with each team member experiencing the other's adventure field. First episode aired in March 2009, which saw Fiennes, Simpson and Knox-Johnson go on a news-gathering trip to Afghanistan. Then the team reported from the Khyber Pass and the Tora Bora mountain complex. And in the other two episodes, they undertook a voyage around Cape Horn and an expedition hauling sledges across the deep frozen Frobisher Bay in the far north of Canada. So again, it's sort of TV programs that he took part in that were documentary in nature, but which were done to give people a flavour of the areas of excellence that these three men excelled in, basically. In 2010, Fiennes was named the UK's top celebrity fundraiser by Just Giving after raising more than $2.5 million for Marie Curie Cancer Care over the previous 2 years, more than any other celebrity fundraiser featured on justgiving.com during the same period. In September 2011, Fiennes was awarded an honorary doctorate in science from Plymouth University, and in 2012 was awarded an honorary fellowship of the University of Glamorgan. In December 2012, he was named one of the Men of the Year for 2012 by Top Gear magazine. And then in October 2014, it was announced that Fiennes would receive an honorary doctorate of science from the University of Chester in recognition of outstanding and inspirational contribution in the field of exploration. So Anna Fiennes is now 76 years old and lives at Greenlands, a rambling hill farm in the wilds of Exmoor, with his second wife, Louise Millington, their daughter, Elizabeth, and his son, Alexander.
He certainly achieved a lot, hasn't he? I guess next week we'll have a closer look at some of the challenges that he's done and his rum making as well, which I hear is rather good.
Yes, absolutely. Are we going to save that for next week, aren't we?
Yeah, you save that till next week. We've gone a little bit over time here, so we'll have to stop now, I think. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, until then, we hope you have a great week ahead of you.